Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Doctors change lives every day, but what happens when life changes yours? A single injury, a sudden illness, your career, your income, your future can shift in an instant. The best physicians don't just plan for success, they protect it. At Set for Life Insurance, they believe financial security isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. True own occupation disability insurance ensures that no matter what happens, your future stays in your hands. Because protecting your income means protecting everything you've built. Visit drpodcastnetwork.co/setforlife today. Secure your future before life makes that choice for you. Welcome back to the podcast. We have a super special guest today, and we're going to be covering a topic that I've wanted to cover for a long time. We cover misinformation a lot on the show, and there's definitely a lot of nutritional misinformation out there. So we're going to get some foundational understanding of what physicians should know about nutrition. So welcome to the show, Susanna Ritchie. She's a registered dietitian with a master's degree in nutritional science from Georgia State University. She currently works for a children's hospital where she works for pediatric primary care and in biochemical genetics, treating inborn errors of metabolism. So all that stuff that we memorized for our exams that a lot of us aren't using anymore, she's actually using this daily. She's passionate about reproductive nutrition, pediatric nutrition misinformation, which is how we got in touch with each other through our online connections and in public health. So Susanna Ritchie, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
So if you could, let's start with a story. So I'm actually going to be changing formats in the podcast a little bit because I just went to a podcasting conference and they were like, Brad, don't just get right into the facts. People like being told stories. So if you could, just tell us a quick story, HIPAA compliant, about how dietary counseling changed someone's life.
Sure. So I feel like I'm cheating a little bit with this question. Just working in inborn errors of metabolism, you get to see pretty concrete evidence that the diet is working. Whereas in other areas of nutrition, working in acute inpatient nutrition, you don't always know if the diet you're implementing is having any effect.
No, if you're writing for TPN, if you're making TPN and the patient doesn't die,
that's always
definitely contributed to that patient's survival. But no, right. I understand what you mean. Like you don't see that dramatic shift because of something specific that you did.
If a kid's less picky one day, then you're like, was that me? Was that something else? But with metabolic disorders, we get to see them when they're first born. And it's always, I think of the most recent family that we met. They have a brand new baby, and then they're told that something is wrong. And it's really scary, but we have figured out how to work with a lot of these disorders, and we can prevent every single problem that comes along with the disorder I'm thinking of is PKU. It's the most common one that we see.
Yeah.
And we can prevent seizures. We can prevent cognitive impairment. We prevent all of the disability that would have gone along with it. So we're able to tell these parents, look, if you follow this diet, then your child will live a very typical life. Just recently, the most recent patients we had, I felt good watching them join the community and see how all of these other families have incorporated diet. They got to see someone who was an adult who has her own kids. So just seeing that the diet really works.
Amazing. So that's very specific to inborn errors of metabolism.
Yes.
But that's not what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about just what physicians should know about the basics of nutrition. And my thought is there's not really that much to know about the basics, like getting the basics right. And so the basics, my understanding, and feel free, please correct me if I'm wrong, is the basics are minimize saturated fats, minimize excess sugar. Like we like to say added sugar, but like apple juice isn't added sugar. They just removed all the good, but you know, that idea of limit sugar and lots of high fiber foods. And so high fiber foods like fruits, vegetables, legumes, that's my understanding of the basics. And yet you'll have these physicians online. And I'm thinking of one in particular. He's like a functional urologist telling me about nutrition. Whereas the nutrition has nothing to do with urology specifically. He's not telling me how to avoid kidney stones, but just like he becomes this functional nutrition zealot and then blasts a bunch of information online. So my question is, what are the basics? What are the few big things that we need to be getting right in our diet?
I do think that you have the basics right. You want variety, moderation, color. You don't want too much sugar, not too much saturated fat. I like pairing different food groups together. If you have a carb, then try to have some protein with that carb. Having half your plate be fruits and vegetables. I honestly do think that my plate is a reasonable, just like basic foundation. And then obviously trying to be patient-centered when incorporating some of those details. I do think that you mentioned misinformation and the urologist saying that. I do think that a lot of the time when we hear this, oh, doctors don't learn about nutrition in medical school. I think half the time we hear that, it is a grifter trying to imply that they know more about nutrition. And then the other half the time, I feel like it could be a dietitian calling out a physician who has turned into a bit of a grifter. So I do feel like there's context to that statement.
Yeah. But in terms of that, so color, variety, minimizing saturated fats, like, or moderating saturated fats, moderating sugar, and then just, you didn't say it, but fiber, right? Fiber is a big one,
right.
Having
so,
lots of fiber in your diet.
Yeah, I think I said in terms of having half of your plate be fruits and vegetables, that's a good way to get fiber, but also beans, seeds.
Okay, this isn't the misinformation episode.
Yes, I think balance is key. People worry about toxic ingredients and they worry about nutrient deficiencies. And that's where balance is actually really nice, is if you have a variety of different foods, then you're limiting the chance that you're getting too much of one thing. And you're also optimizing the chance of getting all of the micronutrients and macronutrients that you need.
So if you were teaching a class to a bunch of medical students, right, or seasoned physicians, right, there was like a monthly meeting of the mid-career doctors, right, and you had a class on nutrition, that's the stuff that you would focus on. Is there anything else that goes to the basics? And the answer might be no.
I do think one of the most important things is just knowing when nutrition can be helpful, okay, because then you know it's an opportunity to refer out. And I think that's one thing most dietitians want physicians to know when this question comes or this statement comes up, that doctors don't know enough about nutrition. They don't have to, because that's why dietitians exist. And we want to be a part of the team. We want to collaborate. So knowing when there is a situation where a dietitian could be helpful, I'd say that is important in addition to the basics.
According to Medicare, in what we should be counseling on diet nutrition with every visit. So a patient comes to me with a peritonsillar abscess. They can't swallow their own saliva. I'm going to need to either drain it or put them on a boatload of medicine. Apparently, that's the time I need to be talking to them about nutrition.
Okay.
So not a great system. But realistically, like you're leading into it, when should we be making that referral? Like, when should we be saying, listen, I'd really like you to speak to a dietitian?
And again, you just brought up insurance. Unfortunately, that is just a big component. It's, I know most physicians want to make sure that the visit is covered, and that depends on what insurance people have. I do feel like we're seeing more and more coverage for prevention, so just people having general questions. I don't love to hear some pretty not great advice about weight loss from physicians, maybe not because they have bad advice, but because they have limited time. And there's no way you can talk about weight loss in 5 minutes. It just is too big of a topic. So that's one area. I think instead of offending someone with the really brief recommendations of things they've probably already tried, that's one consideration. Anytime there's any sense of disordered eating, I would consider an eating disorder dietitian, therapist, all of that. And then just specific nutrition-related conditions, diabetes, heart disease.
Kidney stones, gout, right? Like things that are specific. There are some specialty-specific things out there.
There are a lot of specialties. I think even like women's health, people are very interested in nutrition. And a lot of times they end up going online because they want nutrition for PCOS or infertility. And it's better to maybe send to someone who you don't want them going online and then falling to it.
Down a rabbit hole. So the point you're making is it's not realistic for physicians to counsel patients on nutrition in any reasonable way. And in fact, if we try to, especially for something like an elevated BMI, we risk alienating the patient because we're not able to have a conversation with enough nuance that really shows them enough respect. If we even try broaching the subject and squeezing something in, hey, have you tried, right, is not great because you should probably lead with questions. And in fact, if the listener is interested, I have a couple of episodes with a psychologist who specializes in patients who carry excess weight, where we talk about the importance of language. So you can look up those last episodes. Her name is Dr. Stephanie S-O-G-G. So definitely check those out if you want to learn how to have these discussions without alienating those patients, because it can be really triggering for them. But let's say we do want to talk about a little bit of nutrition in the limited time we have. So just a little nugget of information. What would your recommendations be about how we can educate in such limited time?
Yeah. And honestly, just like you said, the main thing is maintaining like a good relationship. So some of those motivational interviewing tactics can be helpful. So if you hear the patient bringing something up themselves, like, oh, I want to eat healthier, then that's an opportunity to be like, okay, so what do you mean by healthier? And then that might be them setting their own goal. And I would rather go with something they've self-identified. If they're not saying anything like that, and you just want some concrete nutrition facts that are generally true, sugar sweetened beverages are a good place to start reducing those. I would never assume someone is drinking them. So I would ask, be like,
drink in your house? So you don't want to accuse anyone of anything. We don't want to make assumptions. Well, hey, what's in your refrigerator where all the drinks are? Yeah.
Yeah. And making a realistic recommendation, not saying never have soda again, but if you're drinking, literally, I was talking to a kid who was drinking 80 ounces of Mountain Dew a day the other day. So I was like, okay, maybe if we can, like you're drinking like 4 20-ounce bottles, maybe if we can do 3, which still felt really terrible, but trying to be realistic.
Yeah. And this is where someone with an online presence is going to be like, so you're recommending that they drink 3 bottles of soda? 60 ounces every day, right?
Exactly.
That's because they're going to hear. They're going to push their own agenda. Okay, so we're going to ask them, because that's something I learned from the pediatricians that refer to me, is they often open with, what do you all drink in your house? And try to get the juices and the sodas and the sweetened beverages out of the house. Seltzer, milk, water, everything else is a treat and should be treated as such out of the house. What happens at your friend's house, your cousin's house, at school, can't control, but you do the shopping. And so get that stuff out of this. That's a great place to start. I love that.
Yeah, I think that.
Anything else? Because let's say they come back with, oh yeah, no, I drink tons of water. So like, where are we taking this next?
Yeah. Then I think fiber is a good next step. Fiber and protein are probably two things that are really helpful to focus on. Protein, just having a little bit at each meal and snack can be helpful. So instead of, if you have chips, that's fine occasionally, but can we add something that makes the chips last? Otherwise, you're just going to be eating chips for hours and hours. So yeah, Pairing snacky foods with protein if you're going to eat them, or better yet, like protein and fruit. But trying to encourage snacks with multiple food groups so that they're actually filling and they are more intentional and more satiating. And then fiber, same thing. Ideally having fruits and veggies. Obviously, you want to see where your patient is starting. If they're not eating any in the day, which I hear that all the time, then starting with one. But if they are, best case scenario, we want them at every meal.
Yeah.
Maybe some snacks.
Hey there, it's Brad. As someone who's passionate about podcasting, I've always thought there should be more support for physicians who want to share their stories and expertise. That's why we're launching Dr. Podcast Network.
We're bringing together a community of physician podcasters with one goal in mind: to provide the tools, connections, and resources you need to grow your show. So whether you've been podcasting for a while or maybe you're just starting, we've designed this network to support you every step of the way, and we're going to help each other rise, not compete.
If this sounds like something you'd benefit from, we'd love for you to join us as we get closer to launch. So you can sign up at drpodcastnetwork.co for early access. Stay tuned for more details in the coming weeks. Really looking forward to what we can create together. Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
So something that I learned from interviewing BJ Fogg, who is like the godfather of habits a few years ago, is people will eat the things they like to eat and they will do the things they like to do. So you're not going to, if you don't like kale, you're not going to eat kale. So when I talk to my patients about this stuff, I just talk about, hey, what are your favorite fruits and vegetables? And they're like, I like celery and apples. Okay, great. Make sure they're always easily accessible, right? They're always prepared. They're always there, because if you're hungry and it's ready, you're going to have it. And if it's not, you're going to have something that's more easily accessible, like some sugar-filled granola bar or something like that. So just make sure the stuff that you like is always easily. And then when we talk to patients, make sure we're talking specifically about fruits and vegetables. So you mentioned fiber.
Yes.
Soluble and insoluble fiber. What's the difference there? And is it something that we need to even know about, the difference between? Like, is it something that we should be aware of? Or is that too in the weeds?
I think that in general, it's too in the weeds. However, if you're thinking about like constipation, diarrhea, you can use them therapeutically for the day-to-day patient.
You can't. It's fiber. You can't break it down. Oh, but
thank you. But insoluble, you can't break it down.
That's the difference. Soluble and insoluble. So you can digest soluble fiber, but you can't digest insoluble fiber. So it's not that it's, is it not that it's soluble? It's that it's digestible. Would that be a more appropriate term for it? Or it has to do with dissolving in water?
I think of it as like the one that forms like a gel. So that's why if you eat oatmeal, it can sometimes form like a little gel and can sometimes make you excrete cholesterol. So I think when I think soluble, I think of like a, something that makes things kind of clump together.
Okay.
If that makes sense. I feel like that's a terrible.
No, listen, I'm thinking of chia seeds because that leads to my next question. So my next question is, are there such a thing as superfoods, or is it just clickbait? Are there any very nutritionally dense foods that you are like, listen, this is my version of a superfood?
Everything you just said, I think we have gone away from the term superfoods, particularly because it's more about how your diet fits together in the end. And there's no one food that makes or breaks your diet. But there certainly are foods that can be really nutrient dense. They have a lot of nutrients and not a ton of calories, or they have nutrients that are harder to come by, like chia seeds having omega-3s. There aren't that many foods aside from seafood that contain those omega-3s. So chia seeds are great. All berries are great. Honestly, most fruits and vegetables are going to be really nutrient dense, just really high in vitamins, minerals, low in calories. Beans, I would list as a, if I have to use the word superfood. And then nuts and seeds, all just like full of antioxidants. I think one reason we've fallen out of love with the term superfoods is it's often used to market really expensive foods, goji berries and acai. So it ended up becoming then elitist, more difficult for people to have good nutrition.
Yeah. It's like a bunch of white people taking a food that indigenous people eat and then being like, this is what we should be eating because this is what the ancient peoples ate. And it's just the first time that this person has happened to hear of this particular food and it's got something in it that's nutritionally beneficial.
Right. So, and like a lot of those foods are great. Acai is great. Quinoa is great.
But not more great than all the other stuff. Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned chia seed because that's my superfood. Like you put a little bit of that in smoothie. Now suddenly the smoothie has a little bit more fiber, a little bit more protein, and it doesn't really change the flavor very much. It does have that because of that.
Soluble, I believe.
Because of the soluble fiber aspect of it, it does make it more dense. So it can make it a slimy consistency or like a thicker consistency. So then it becomes, then my kids don't end up drinking it because it's too thick. And so then I ruined it again. Thank you. We'll sprinkle that on their oatmeal and in our oatmeal to just add this little extra layer of nutrition. So that, for me, chia seeds are my superfood, and I grew up in the chia pet era. So if you want, you can spread them on a piece of clay and maybe you can grow your own next generation of chia seeds.
And you're right. I think with kids, if you get it started early enough to where they're not like freaked out by little black dots, then they can't taste them. Like it's a great way to incorporate fiber, some omega-3s.
Sneak it in there.
Protein, yeah.
So are there any nutritional red flags? And I think you went over it already with the juice or the complete absence of fruits and vegetables. But are there any other nutritional red flags that we should be looking for? Like goldfish crackers?
Not like a single food necessarily. I'd say we're seeing more people doing extreme diets like carnivore diet. It's probably going to be difficult to talk someone out of that, but that is
right. Because they're probably a zealot. They're probably a zealot. If they're doing that, then often people treat it like religion.
And they're going to assume that they know a lot more than you do. Extreme restrictive diets are concerning to me. Arbitrarily restricted food groups. If someone doesn't know why they've eliminated gluten or dairy. There are specific nutrients that come from those foods. And every extra food group you eliminate makes it harder to get all of the nutrients that we need. Thing I keep in mind is supplements. People just don't realize that supplements can interact with their medications. They can have negative effects in and of themselves. Sometimes the dose that's being sold isn't necessarily optimum. So I think just encouraging people to share what they're taking with you. And I have to look things up every single time. Like it's impossible to keep track of all the supplements, but that's one thing. Whenever I see something strange or something that could become toxic at high doses that I pay attention to.
What about patients that are on a budget or like in a food desert, right? So there's an issue with access, either because food is expensive or because they just don't have access because they just live in a place with not a lot of opportunities. Like they've got to go shopping at a convenience store instead of a grocery store with lots of fresh fruit. So do you have any helpful hints for how we can guide these patients?
Yeah. So first of all, one thing I hear frequently is people on budgets don't like wasting food. And if you buy a lot of produce, then a lot of times it goes to waste. So leaning into frozen fruits and vegetables can make it so that you're only using
what you need. Yeah.
Canned is great. Obviously, if you need to have like a discussion about sodium, some canned goods do have more sodium, but there's plenty of options with less. So canned fruits and veggies, frozen, dried, some of these shelf stable options can help reduce waste and save money in the long term. And then I also just recommend, sometimes this isn't totally realistic, but dried beans and peanut butter and things that last a long time.
Makes sense also for those of us who are doomsday prepping. They last a long time and they're very nutritionally and calorically dense. And so, yes, dried beans and peanut butter, great for people on a budget and great for doomsday prepping.
I don't know why I say dried. They can be canned. They're a little bit more cost effective when dry, but that takes a long time.
Yeah. And then by the time it's ready, it's prepared, you're not hungry anymore. You've done your snacking. Are there any dietary patterns? One thing that you've harped on has been like disordered eating in extreme diets, right? Make sure that's not happening with your patients, because it can be dangerous, because variety is really important in a human diet. But are there any dietary patterns that have shown promise? Like, we hear a lot about the Mediterranean diet, or we hear things about intermittent fasting. There was a paper that showed that intermittent fasting does have some cardiovascular risks to it. It wasn't conclusive by any means, but it also throws some doubt in there for people that were like, this is the bee's knees. But are there dietary patterns that do show promise for nutritional benefits?
Yeah, like you said, Mediterranean is probably going to be like the favorite dietary pattern, if I'm going to pick a pattern. That said,
that's not funded by Big Mediterranean?
Big not seafood, to my knowledge.
Italy, Greece?
Garbanzo bean, don't know. So you can find studies that will support any of these dietary patterns. A lot of times, because they're reducing calories, people are losing adipose tissue, and that does have some health benefits. The problem is we know that they can be really difficult to stick to, and the farther it is from the person's original way of eating, the harder it's going to be to stick to. So if you have someone whose diet doesn't remotely resemble Mediterranean diet pattern, and then you tell them to do that, they might do it for a while and they might feel great, but is it going to last? So sustainability is more important to me than what we see in some of these short-term studies.
Yeah.
And then also, we don't know the long-term effects of a lot of these diets, because the research, they just can't do those studies for that long.
Yeah. You don't have 20 years that you're following a large enough cohort of patients to be able to tell, is this really making a difference? And those patients, we need to stay within those restrictions of the diet. So hard to draw those conclusions. Yes.
People want a plan. So like, I understand that. And that's why sometimes I will say the Mediterranean diet, because it is a good plan, but if you don't like seafood, or there are a lot of reasons why it might not work for someone.
Yeah.
And I'd like to look at the patient's current diet and make changes around what they're already doing, as opposed to starting with something.
Yeah. You can't really erase different. The blackboard and start fresh with a human. Right. You've got to work with what you've got, kind of like parenting. You got to realize that you're not engineering something from scratch here. You're guiding something that's, a lot of it is predetermined. So the diet is what it is, and you can make small adjustments here and there within their means that fits with their budget and their lifestyle and what they like and what they will do and what they can change. So a lot of variables. All the more reason to refer to your friendly neighborhood registered dietitian.
Appreciate that.
All right.
And well, then with intermittent fasting, the one thing I think about there.
Yeah.
People do love it, and I don't want to discount that. One thing I think about is I'm always talking to people about trying to pay attention to their hunger cues. And with intermittent fasting, you're intentionally disregarding them.
Yeah.
So that is something to consider, especially with someone who already has a history of not necessarily listening to their body.
You're throwing another monkey wrench. And I like how some of these diets just have fancy names, like intermittent fasting. It used to be called skipping breakfast.
Exactly.
Some people just skip breakfast.
Like all the teenagers I see are skipping breakfast, and I'm trying to get them to eat something before school.
Right. And yeah, they've got to wake up at 6 in the morning in order to make it to the bus on time.
Exactly.
That's a whole nother podcast. Susanna Ritchie, can you tell people where they can find you online? Because that's how I found you. And I love learning from you and all the information you put out there.
Yeah, so I'm on TikTok and Instagram and Threads. All of them are Susanna, Susanna, Ritchie, Ritchey, RD.
Because a dietitian is a graduate level education, and a nutritionist is
anything.
Everyone can just call themselves a nutritionist. So that's also an important point I want everyone to leave with. Susanna Ritchie, thank you so much for your time and all you do for your patients.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review. Something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.